Southern Fraud True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners. And there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Fred Jablin was a man of routine. Every day, he would wake up at 6 a.m., put on a pot of coffee, and then go out the back door to grab the newspaper from the driveway. Reading the paper while drinking fresh brewed coffee was Fred's favorite way to start the day. The morning of October 30th, 2004 was supposed to be like all the others. Fred woke up, put on a pot of coffee, and walked out the back door to grab the paper. He would have had an extra spring in his step. It was almost Halloween, his favorite holiday. It was Saturday, so he could lounge around, enjoying his coffee and paper. He was probably excited to get the candy ready for trick-or-treaters the next night. On Halloween day, he was supposed to take his three kids on a hayride before carving pumpkins and then getting into costumes. But he would never get to drink that coffee or enjoy his Saturday before All Hallows' Eve. Fred was walking out his own back door into an ambush. Just before 6:40 a.m., a Henrico County, Virginia man named Bob called 911 to report three gunshots he had just heard in his residential neighborhood. Police arrived in the neighborhood and started searching, but they didn't find anything. At 7 a.m., they called Bob back to tell him the news. Bob said he would take his dog for a walk when the sun came up, and if he saw anything, he'd give them a call back. Less than 30 minutes later, Bob and his wife were walking their dogs when Bob noticed something crumpled up in a neighbor's driveway. It was the body of 52-year-old Fred Jablin. He had been shot twice. Another neighbor later told the press that because it was such a nice neighborhood, if you didn't know any better and saw the yellow crime scene tape across the Jablin driveway, you would just think it was a Halloween decoration. Welcome to episode 167, The Murder of Fred Jablin. Frederick Mark Jablin was born on July 23, 1952, in Queens, New York. His father, Irving, was an accountant, and his mother, Mildred, was a stay-at-home mom, while Fred and his older brother, Michael, were young. She later became a bookkeeper. The Jablins raised their two sons in Floral Park, a Jewish working-class neighborhood. Growing up, Fred wanted to be a scientist. He would later graduate with a doctorate, but he didn't exactly become a scientist like he had dreamed of. Instead, he conducted groundbreaking research in the communications field. At the time of his death, he was a very distinguished university professor and department chair. Aside from Fred's intelligence, he was known for having a playful nature, a sharp sense of humor, and a zest for living. One friend told Catherine Casey, author of Die, My Love, that Fred had an infectious curiosity that made him stand out in a crowd. Another said Fred had a wry sense of humor and a contagious love of life. Fred graduated from the State University of New York with a bachelor's in political science and speech. He then went to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and earned a master's degree in communication. But Fred wasn't done with school yet. He then graduated from Purdue University with a PhD in organizational communication. After earning his PhD, Fred accepted an assistant professor position at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee. There, he wrote his breakthrough article. It was about supervisor and subordinate communication. The article was accepted for publication in the Psychological Bulletin, a monthly peer-reviewed academic journal. A friend and colleague of Fred's told Catherine Casey, at that point, organizational communication was just getting its legs. Getting an article published in another discipline's leading journal was a coup. With that paper, Fred leapfrogged to the head of his class and built a reputation for himself in the field. Not long after writing the breakthrough article, Fred was offered a teaching position at the University of Texas at Austin. He accepted and became a professor of organizational communication. At UT Austin, Fred met and befriended fellow professor John Daly. He later said, "Fred was a true teacher at heart. There was nothing he enjoyed more than working one-on-one with a bright student." In his first 5 years at the university, Fred wrote 13 articles for scholarly journals and was officially considered an expert in the field. He won many awards for his groundbreaking research. Fred bought a house on Harper's Ferry Lane in Austin. This was game-changing for Fred. He loved Halloween and would decorate his house in cobwebs, spiders, and a dummy he named Mr. Myers. He would carve pumpkins and host an annual Halloween party. John Daly told Catherine Casey, "Fred believed that Halloween was a time when you could be a different person. He'd spend days making sure the decorations were just right, arranging and rearranging the cobwebs so they looked real." Fred also obsessed over his costumes. His favorite was an elaborate wizard costume. In the fall of 1981, John introduced Fred to one of his students, a young woman named Piper Roundtree. Fred soon learned that Piper had previously been in one of his classes, but since it was such a large class, he didn't remember her. For a girl he couldn't remember, the determined Piper was about to take over his life. Piper and Fred were the epitome of opposites attract. Catherine Casey described Fred as precise and exacting, and Piper as a free spirit. John Daly said they each found something in the other that they lacked. Piper helped make Fred, quote, "more of a person." I take that to mean a more easygoing, fun person. Fred was a brilliant, accomplished academic, so perhaps he was a little awkward, and Piper helped smooth out the edges. And Fred offered Piper financial support and commitment. They said he waited on her hand and foot. It would seem he adored her, at least in the beginning. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Piper Ann Roundtree was born on January 6, 1960 in Japan to parents Bill and Betty. Piper was 8 years younger than her soon-to-be husband, but she was used to being the youngest. She was the spoiled baby sister of five siblings. She was very close to all of her family, but she shared a special bond with her sister Tina, who was also 8 years older than her. The Roundtree family lived all over the place until Bill retired. Then they settled in Harlingen, Texas. According to Piper, she grew up thinking her parents were divorced because Bill was gone for many of her school years. She felt like she barely knew her own father. When he was home, he was drinking. And when he drank, he was mean. Betty was described as a good mom by Piper's childhood friends. She went to PTA meetings and was always there for her kids. However, Piper later told a psychiatrist that Betty wasn't ever around. It was Tina who raised her. Tina told a different story to Catherine Casey, saying, "Piper was the baby of the family, and my mom was really protective. She would give Piper a lot of attention." Piper, a bookworm, graduated from Harlingen High School in 1978. She was very popular there and was a top student. She was a member of the National Honor Society, the Student Council, and the Yearbook Committee. She was the editor of the school's literary publication, and she participated in speech, drama, tennis, and choir. In 1978, Piper started at the University of Texas in Austin. She majored in speech and studied German. She was already fluent in Spanish. It was the fall of 1981 that Piper's teacher, John Daly, introduced her to Dr. Fred Jablin. At this point, Piper was a senior at the university. She would often talk to John in between classes. One day, he told Piper about an event he and Fred were going to. She asked if she could go, and John said yes. He ended up having to cancel at the last minute, but he asked Fred to still go. Fred went, and he and Piper seemed to fall for each other right away. By December 1981, they were living together. In the spring of 1982, Piper graduated with a bachelor's in communication in German. Then she left for a year on a scholarship in Germany. While there, Piper met another man. When Fred found out, he flew over to win her back. His plan worked. She came back to him when the scholarship was over, and they moved back in together. In the fall of 1983, Piper enrolled in a San Antonio law school, with Fred paying her tuition, of course. Then on October 14, 1983, Fred and Piper got married. It wasn't long before Fred found out that Piper wasn't exactly who he thought she was. She was very demanding, and she had a formidable temper, which she wasn't afraid to show. Despite all of this, Fred remained an extremely devoted partner. When Piper's law school grades dropped, Fred put his beloved house up for rent and moved to San Antonio to help support her. He continued working in Austin, driving 3 hours round trip to work every day for 2 years. Fred's sacrifices seemed to be worth it in the end. Piper graduated from law school in the spring of 1986, and the couple moved back to Austin. She enjoyed painting while studying for the bar and looking for a job. By October, she had a job with the Hayes County District Attorney's Office, but just a year later, Piper was unemployed. When people asked why she left the DA's office, Piper said she didn't feel safe as a prosecutor after a man came in to negotiate a plea deal and took out a gun and put it in between them. The truth was that she had been fired. This would be the beginning of a pattern of lying in Piper's life. She always bent the truth to make herself sound better or to sound like the victim in any situation. She was able to get a new job at the Texas Association of School Boards fairly quickly after being fired. In 1988, Piper and Fred started talking about having children, and in July 1989, the couple welcomed a daughter, Jocelyn. Piper continued to work while Jocelyn went to daycare. But then, Piper quit the School Board Association and took a higher-paying job at a law firm. A year later, she was unemployed again. She told people that she was fired for being pregnant with her second child, but the firm said it was for a lack of performance. Looking back at the academic accomplishments of Piper Rowntree, you would think she was destined for success like her husband. Maybe she was one of those people who thrives in an insulated school environment, but struggles out in the real world. In March of 1992, Piper gave birth to a boy named Paxton. She ended up experiencing intense postpartum depression. She spent weeks in bed and didn't have the energy to care for her newborn. When she recovered, Piper then went to work for the Texas Classroom Teachers Association. After a year, she was let go for, quote, not having passion for the job. Then Piper impetuously opened up her own law office, which was unsuccessful from the get-go. Then in 1993, she found out she was pregnant with her third child. But this time, there were complications, and well into the pregnancy, Piper suffered a miscarriage. It was a very difficult time for Piper and Fred. They were devastated, and Piper fell into another deep depression. She decided she wanted to stay home with the kids. She no longer wanted to work. To help pay the bills, Fred took on consulting work, something he didn't want to do, but felt he had to do to keep the family afloat. The second job didn't last long, not because Fred gave it up, but because Piper demanded he be at home more with her and the kids. Around the same time that Piper said she wanted to stay home, the Jablins started going to marriage counseling. According to Catherine Casey, they might have started counseling because of something Piper did. Shortly after Paxton was born, Piper withdrew her retirement fund, which was around $1,600. She combined that with $1,400 from a joint account with Fred, and then she paid for breast implant surgery. Maybe it doesn't sound like a huge amount she took from their joint account, but it's worth about $3,000 today, which adds perspective. She didn't tell Fred until 2 days before the surgery, and he didn't want Piper to get the surgery. He was worried about leaking implants and how breastfeeding would work. But Piper didn't care about his concerns. Yes, it was her body and her choice, but healthy couples discuss major medical decisions. And one partner should not be sneaking money out of a joint account. That's a major breach of trust. Then, in 1994, Fred was offered a job at the University of Richmond in Virginia. This job paid a lot more than his position in Texas. The Jablins bought a house on Hearthglow Lane in the Kingsley suburb of Richmond. It was a nice house, a two-story red brick home set far off from the street. In December 1995, Piper gave birth to another daughter, Callan, or Callie for short. Once again, Piper suffered from postpartum depression. Except this time, when the postpartum left, motherhood didn't come as naturally as it had with her first two kids. Callie needed attention, but Piper didn't have any to give to her. In 1996, Piper and Fred were back in marriage counseling. She said she felt underappreciated and ignored. She wanted Fred to pay more attention to her and the kids. She complained that Fred kept her on a financial leash. She wanted to be in control of the money. So, Fred gave her the control. He always tried to give her what she wanted. By 1998, people were starting to notice that Piper didn't really seem to care about her children. She wouldn't even pick them up from school if they were sick. She would escape to her neighbor Mel's house, just to get away for a little while, she said. Mel would then look outside her window and see Callie playing in the yard by herself. She would have been just over 2 years old. Fred ended up sending Callie to daycare, so he knew she would be cared for. He hired nannies and cleaning ladies, even though Piper didn't work, but she would often fire them. Fred told his friend, John Daly, that Piper was never happy. No matter what he did, it wasn't enough. But he said he loved Piper and had to keep trying. The year 1999 was another tough one for the Jablin family. Piper started having an affair, something Fred knew nothing about, at least for a while. She was also diagnosed with a possible mood disorder and put on antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication. Also during this time, Piper racked up $32,000 in debt while being in charge of finances. That would be over $57,000 today. When Fred found out, he took back control of the finances and told her she needed to get a job and help pay off the debt. Piper ended up taking over an attorney's office who was looking to retire, but she didn't have a license to practice in Virginia. It wasn't long before the Bar Association found out that Piper was practicing law without a Virginia license. She was ordered to take their bar exam, and Fred paid the $3,000 for a University of Richmond review course to help Piper pass the bar. He also hired a full-time housekeeper to help Piper at home while she studied. But she failed the bar exam and fell into another deep depression. In early May 2000, Fred and Piper started seeing a therapist, whom Piper had already been seeing by herself for couples counseling. The therapist quickly realized that Fred was sincerely concerned about Piper. He was not the way Piper had made him out to be during their solo sessions. That same month, Piper had a hysterectomy and again became very depressed. Fred took care of the kids that summer while she did her own thing. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from one of today's sponsors. I am the worst about canceling subscriptions. I've kept newspaper subscriptions for certain small towns for years, for episodes that I could not access the sources without the subscription. And then I would just keep forgetting to cancel it or keep putting it off. And that's why I love using Rocket Money, formerly known as Truebill. The app shows all your subscriptions in one place and then cancels for you whatever you don't still want. Rocket Money can even find subscriptions you didn't know you were still paying for. You may even find out you've been double charged for a subscription. To cancel a subscription, all you have to do is press cancel, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Get rid of useless subscriptions with Rocket Money now. Go to rocketmoney.com/southernfried. Seriously, it could save you hundreds per year. That's rocketmoney.com/southernfried. Cancel your unnecessary subscriptions right now at rocketmoney.com/southernfried. By the fall of 2000, Fred moved into a separate bedroom so Piper could sleep better. Neighbors say her mood darkened. She was rarely seen around the house. She eventually asked Fred for an apartment of her own so she could paint, even though she had the whole house to herself during the day. In December 2000, 2 days before the Jablin family was supposed to go to Disney World, Piper called her neighbor Linda and asked to borrow her car. Linda thought it was for an errand, so she said yes. Hours passed, and Piper didn't return. Linda called her and asked where she was. Piper said calmly, "I don't know." More hours passed, and her neighbor Mel got a call about Piper being at a doctor's office. The caller said Piper couldn't drive. She needed a ride home. So Mel went to get her, and she wasn't even able to walk. She was nearly unconscious because the staff had given her something to calm her down. Mel and her husband took Piper home. When they carried her inside the Jablin house, the kids were unfazed by their mother's condition or her absence. Then Mel called Fred and told him to come home. Later that night, Piper called Linda and asked her to come over and tell her what had happened that day. When Linda went to the house, she said Piper was manic and pacing. She ordered Linda to tell her everything. Linda told Piper what happened, but then she started yelling that Fred was drugging her, and Linda got uncomfortable and left. The next morning, Mel got a call from Fred asking where Piper and Callie were. Mel said she didn't know. She hadn't seen either of them since she had dropped Piper off the day before. Come to find out, Piper had called her sister Tina in the middle of the night and said Fred was drugging her. She said she was scared and wanted to travel to Houston with Callie. Piper packed her suitcases and called a limo service to take her and Callie to the airport. She didn't tell Fred, but he eventually found out where they were. It is unclear if he asked her to come home, but we do know that he still took the other two kids to Disney. He probably didn't want to ruin their vacation. While in Houston, Piper told Tina that after she got home on the day she borrowed Linda's car, Fred was angry. She claimed he ripped her clothes off and put her to bed, calling her an embarrassment, and she said that Fred drugged her. Tina, a nurse practitioner, felt like Piper was suffering from exhaustion and that Fred was undermining her self-esteem. Basically, everything was Fred's fault. Meanwhile, Fred, Jocelyn, and Paxton spent a week at Disney, then they flew to Texas to see Piper and Callie. A few days later, the whole Jablin family went back to Richmond after it was agreed that Fred would find a teaching job in Texas. He even applied for his old position at the University of Texas at Austin. Once again, Fred was giving in to Piper's every demand. He would really do anything for his family. But the good times never lasted long. On January 6, 2001, Piper moved out of the house and moved in with her friend Lonnie, who was getting a divorce. 5 days later, on January 11th, Piper called the police and said that Fred had pushed her into a wall during an argument. She had a small cut on one hand, but said she didn't think it was from the argument. When police showed up, Fred told them that there had been a verbal argument. Police asked the kids, who were witnesses, and they said nothing physical happened. Piper was adamant that Fred had pushed her. She said that Fred was definitely abusive, and they could ask her friend Mel. So police talked to Mel, and Mel said no, that was not true. Fred was far from abusive. A week later, on January 18th, Fred sent Piper an email saying that he wanted to stay together. He still cared about her and missed her. He suggested that they stay married but live in separate bedrooms while they saw a counselor. He said he would keep looking for a job in Texas. If he couldn't find one, he'd take leave from the University of Richmond in July and then move to Texas with her and the kids. It is unknown what Piper's reaction to this email was. On February 4th, Fred found out that soon after their return from Richmond, Piper had stolen his MasterCard and ordered a Citibank card with his information. In 30 days, she had taken out $9,000 in cash advances and made nearly $11,000 in purchases. She also transferred $3,000 of his paycheck to an account she opened at a different bank. She bought clothes, tennis equipment, 3 years' worth of hair salon services, and $7,000 in prepaid moving expenses. That's $30,000 in 2001, which would be about $50,000 today. The next day, February 5th, Piper took Jocelyn to a doctor's appointment and then checked into a hotel with her kids. She called Mel and said that she was afraid Fred would have her arrested. On February 7th, Piper and the kids were still in the hotel. Piper told Mel she thought the police were going to get her at any time. And then Piper called her psychiatrist to cancel her appointment. The psychiatrist told her that her actions were part of a pattern of chaos. Her emotions were out of control. He wanted her to take medicine for mood swings. Later that day, Piper went to file a restraining order against Fred. She said that on January 11th, Fred had been physically abusive. Hours after filing the order, police arrested Fred at the campus for domestic violence. After his release the same day, a defeated and probably very embarrassed Fred moved to a motel while Piper and the kids lived in the house. On March 11th, Fred went to an emergency hearing and asked for temporary custody. He said the kids were unsafe with Piper, and the judge agreed. The next day, Piper filed another report of domestic violence against Fred. Then she went home and took all the items she wanted from the house, including Fred's mother's piano, and moved into a townhouse. Naturally, she didn't tell Fred. But Fred still wasn't ready to give up. He begged Piper to come back for the kids, but Piper said no. With no other move to make, Fred asked his attorney to file for divorce on grounds of desertion. On March 16th, a judge lifted the restraining order and let Fred move back into the house. The judge also ruled again that Fred would have temporary custody of their children. Piper later filed a cross complaint asking for her own divorce. She said Fred was cruel and was both verbally and physically abusive, and she asked for joint custody. At this point, Fred was caring for the children on his own while paying Piper over $1,100 in alimony a month. He needed more money, so when he was asked to step in as the acting dean, a job that would come with a pay raise, Fred said yes, and then he hired a nanny. As the year went on, things with Piper continued to spiral downward, and Fred became more worried for his safety. He created a new will, saying that his brother Michael would get custody of the kids if anything happened to him. He also installed a security system, and he talked to the kids about what they should do if their mom came to take them away. By then, the kids would have been around the ages 13, 10, and 7. Jocelyn and Paxton had witnessed so much drama from their mother over the years. And poor Callie. Well, she was more neglected by Piper than anything. But imagine basically explaining to your kids what to do if their own mom came to kidnap them. On July 18th, Fred filed for full custody. He was worried about Piper's behavior. She had been doing a lot of odd things, like sending an email to a bunch of people, including Fred and her son Paxton, about an idea for a new type of computer joystick that could be used for sexual pleasure. Other concerning behavior included letting the kids cross a four-lane road by themselves to go to a gas station. The list went on and on. Fred was genuinely worried about the children when they were with their mother. He needed full custody so he could keep them safe. In September, the judge ruled that Fred would have physical custody, but he and Piper would both continue to have temporary joint custody. The judge ordered a psychiatrist to evaluate both to see who was suitable to raise the kids. As the months passed, Fred continued trying to be as cordial as possible to Piper. On January 7th, 2002, a hearing was held to go over the psychiatry evaluations for Piper and Fred. Dr. Lee Hagen, a psychiatrist, testified about the results. He speculated that Piper had ADD, bipolar, dissociative disorder, issues with substance abuse, or what he called a character disorder, because of her socially unacceptable behavior. Dr. Hagen said he leaned more towards a dissociative disorder and said that Piper was hyper-emotional and might have impaired judgment. But he also said there was nothing damaging about Fred. He relied on tact and diplomacy. According to Catherine Casey on March 5, 2002, the judge said that both Piper and Fred loved their children. However, the animosity between them was potentially detrimental to their children. The judge said, Dr. Jablin is more of a peacemaker, more able to bend. He brought up that Piper's own psychiatrist said Piper's mental health improved while Fred had custody. Which is telling. Piper's mental health improved when she wasn't responsible for her children. It's sad that she could not accept that. Because of these reasons and others, the judge ruled that Piper and Fred would have joint legal custody, but Fred would have permanent physical custody of all three children. Piper was inconsolable when she found out. She told her friends that Fred used his expertise in communication to manipulate the judge. She didn't tell them that it was actually her bizarre behavior that caused the judge's decision. 3 days after the hearing, Piper emailed a 42-page document to a bunch of people Fred knew. The email subject line was Jablin's psychological profile, and it was marked relevant if you have children he supervises. The body of the email read, after serious consideration of the wider implications of the attached court report, I am forwarding it to you. But what she forwarded was not an official court document. It was just a Word document, full of lies, that Piper's sister Tina typed up. She even listed a bunch of fake credentials to make the document look more official. According to Catherine Casey, the document was a direct assault on Fred Jablin's character, morals, and ethics. Tina wrote that Fred was a narcissist. He didn't care about anyone but himself, and he lacked empathy for everyone, including Piper and the kids. Tina wrote that Fred had violent and dangerous outbursts and showed a calculated pattern of intentional neglect. She said the children were at a high risk for psychological abuse. She wrote that Fred frequently smoked pot and that he had physically and sexually assaulted Piper. He never gave Piper any money or affection, and that Fred hated children and never wanted them. Tina wrote that Fred beat Paxton, and that Jocelyn's psychiatrist said that since Fred started caring for the children, Jocelyn had been bordering on anorexia and suicide for months. This is not what the psychiatrist said. In fact, he said the opposite. Tina also added that Fred beat Paxton. And of course, she couldn't end the document without a racist comment about Jewish people having a persecution complex. The document was very damning to Fred's reputation. He had to make many embarrassing phone calls, telling people who got the email that it was all lies. But in the end, Fred didn't feel that was enough, so he withdrew his name from consideration from the permanent deanship. He also told Piper that her actions were detrimental to the children's welfare. Yet still, over the summer, Fred remained as cordial as ever. Even though he didn't legally have to, Fred always told Piper what was going on with the children and what their plans were. Piper would in turn fight Fred on everything. Her behavior had a profound effect on the children. According to the neighbors, they became quieter, withdrawn, and less interested in playing with friends. On July 15th, Piper and Fred went to court to discuss the document Piper sent out. At the hearing, Fred asked the judge to finalize their divorce. His request was granted. Piper and Fred were officially divorced. Then Fred asked that he be granted full permanent custody. He said, I cannot trust Piper's judgment. This email shows a person who does not know right from wrong has no moral standards, will lie and spread hatred. She does not have the welfare of the children at heart. The judge gave Fred full permanent custody and limited Piper's visitation to twice monthly weekends, holidays, and 3 weeks of summer. Following this ruling, Piper told a friend, "Fred torched my village." In August, Piper moved to Houston and started living with Tina. She didn't tell Fred she was moving. He heard about it from the kids. Then, Piper started working as a guardian ad litem. She was an attorney in charge of overseeing the best interests of other people's minor children in divorce cases. Good Lord, the irony. Her business card said that she had 20 years of experience. Yeah, 20 years of screwing up her own children's lives. After she was ultimately fired from being a guardian, Piper took a job working as a landman in the oil field. As the months passed, Fred emailed Piper about the kids and their activities, and she, for once, appeared to be cordial. That didn't last long. By the summer of 2004, Piper was not paying child support. She was over $8,000 behind at that point, close to $13,000 in 2022 dollars. Even though she wasn't paying anything, Piper demanded that Fred pay to fly all three children out to see her in Texas. She said he had to do it. But Fred knew better. There was nothing in the agreement stating that he had to do that. So he didn't. He was finally standing up for himself. That had to feel good. Despite his issues with Piper, things in Fred's romantic life were going well. He had started dating a woman named Charlene and had even introduced the kids to her. He was moving on. He was finally happy again. In October 2004, Fred and the children got ready for Fred's favorite holiday by decorating the outside of the house with a homemade scarecrow, carved pumpkins, and sheet ghosts. For Halloween Day, Fred had plans to take the children to a local farm so they could pick out pumpkins and go on a hayride. But that trip would never happen. I'm going to pause now for a final word from today's sponsors. Here at Southern Fraud, there's one crime we don't cover, and that's how some home security companies rob you blind with monthly fees. SimpliSafe Home Security is different. They keep you safe and help you save. Right now, our listeners can get 40% off SimpliSafe's advanced security system. I use and trust SimpliSafe because at SimpliSafe, your safety is the only thing that matters. And as the girl who never answers the door, not even now that she's a grown-up, I'm glad the days of peeking through curtains are over. I love that SimpliSafe app on my phone. When a threat is detected, SimpliSafe's monitoring professionals promptly contact you and dispatch first responders to your home, even if you're away or unable to respond. 24/7 professional monitoring costs under $1 a day. SimpliSafe blankets your home in protection, with advanced sensors for every room, window, and door, along with hazard sensors to detect fires, floods, and home threats. Their HD cameras inside and out are top of the line, and watching their crystal clear live stream is very reassuring. Save big today when you protect your home with the best. Get 40% off your order when you visit simplysafe.com/southernfraud today. Customize the perfect system for your home in just a few minutes. That's simplysafe.com/southernfraud. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. And now, a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. I consider myself a problem solver. I like to figure things out on my own. Some people think they don't need therapy, but actually, a therapist helps you become a better problem solver. I've used therapy for many different crises in my life, but as I've gotten older, I've realized it's more than just for a current problem. Therapy helps with my anxiety and stress. Those are issues that don't go away. Therapy helps keep me on track on my bad days, and I've got someone objective to talk to. If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, accessible, affordable, and entirely online. Get matched with a therapist after filling out a brief survey and switch therapists at any time. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can get you there. Visit BetterHelp.com/Southern today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/Southern. On Wednesday, October 27th, Piper told her boss she couldn't work on Thursday or Friday because she had a continuing education class. This was a blatant lie. Piper wasn't taking a continuing education class. She did have other plans, though. On the morning of October 30th, 52-year-old Fred followed his daily routine. Wake up at 6 a.m., put on the coffee, and grab the newspaper from the driveway. At 6:37 a.m., Fred walked out his back door to grab the paper. Because it was still dark outside, Fred could not see that Piper was waiting in the driveway for him. She ambushed her ex-husband, shooting and killing him while their children slept inside. Fred's next-door neighbor, Bob, called 911 to report 3 gunshots. He told the dispatcher that after hearing shots, he looked out his window and saw a shadowy figure running left to right across his lawn. Police arrived in the neighborhood and started searching, but they didn't find anything. At 7 a.m., they contacted Bob to tell him the news, and Bob said he would take his dogs for a walk when it got light out, and if he saw anything, he would give them a call. Bob and his wife were walking the dogs by Fred's driveway when he noticed something crumpled up in the driveway. His wife said to go check what it was. It was Fred. He was lying in his driveway, on his stomach, with his head turned to the side. He had landed on a bed of leaves, in a fetal position, staring toward the street, with his glasses lying on the ground. Bob turned to his wife and told her to call the police. It was 7:25 a.m. The police came back, and paramedics showed up soon after, but it was too late. Fred was dead from 2 gunshot wounds. Later, an autopsy would show that the first of 2 bullets entered from the back, piercing Fred's lower right side. The bullet did a lot of damage to organs and was a fatal shot. The second bullet entered Fred's right arm and exited without hitting any vital tissues. The killer most likely stood near the garage and waited for Fred to get his newspaper. Then they approached him and fired. No casings were found at the site, meaning the weapon was most likely a revolver. Because no one knew where the shooter was, it was unclear if the children were being held hostage inside the house. SWAT arrived and made their way inside to rescue the children. Just then, 15-year-old Jocelyn came out of her room, confused about what was going on. Officers escorted her out of the house. Next, they went to 8-year-old Callie's room and woke her. Then they woke up 12-year-old Paxton. On the way to a rescue vehicle, the children were directed away from where Fred lay in the driveway. They were taken to the home of a police officer's family. The family lived nearby, and the kids were on the same soccer team. Henrico County Police quickly got to work investigating Fred's murder. They started searching the sewer for the murder weapon, talking to witnesses, obtaining search warrants, and swabbing for DNA. Officers called Fred's brother Michael to relay the bad news. After the initial shock, he asked if they considered Piper to be a suspect. When officers spoke with the neighbor Mel, she told them about Piper and Fred's new girlfriend Charlene. After Mel explained all the things that had happened during the Jablins' divorce, officers could see why Michael asked if Piper was a suspect yet. Police interviewed Charlene, who said she had talked to Fred the night before. They talked about how Fred was going to let the kids go to Texas for Thanksgiving, but how he also had to email Piper about money she owed. Police also spoke with the Jablin children. Jocelyn said she had heard the shots, but she didn't know what the sound truly was, so she went back to sleep. All 3 kids said their relationship with their father was great. There were no problems, and nothing unusual had happened recently. They said their mom had called them the night before to say she was driving home from Galveston. After hearing this information, officers wanted to obtain Piper's phone and bank records to see if she was telling the truth. They also asked Houston police to go to Piper's and see if she was home. She was not. By 11 a.m., Henrico police had Piper's phone records. They found that she had made calls from her cell that bounced off towers in Richmond. She made a call at 4:30 a.m. and it bounced off a tower 5 miles from Fred's house. By noon, it was used in Norfolk, Virginia. 1.5 hours later, it was used in Baltimore, Maryland. With this information, officers knew Piper had flown somewhere. So an officer drove to the Norfolk airport and found out that Atina Roundtree had flown out of Norfolk at 12:30 p.m. That plane changed in Baltimore and was going to land in Houston at 4:30 Central. Henrico called Houston police and asked for officers to go to the airport with pictures of Piper and Tina. They needed to see which one got off the airplane, then seize any luggage until police had a warrant. But the Houston police did not find Piper or Tina at the airport. They were too late. One Houston officer headed to Tina's house to see if Piper was there, and another went to Piper's house. Neither were home. By the evening hours, police had obtained more of Piper's cell phone records. These showed that at 4:46 a.m., someone checked messages on Piper's phone near Fred's house. The tower was by a bunch of hotels. Police then checked with those hotels to see if Piper or Tina had been registered. A clerk at Homestead Suites said that Atina Roundtree had a reservation for last night, but did not check in. At around 9 p.m., Henrico Detective Kobe Kelly finally got a hold of Piper. She immediately asked where her kids were. Kelly said he wanted to talk to her about that. But first, he asked about her divorce. She said Fred was physically abusive and then changed the subject. She said she wanted to come and get the kids because she had custody. No matter what Detective Kelly said, Piper only wanted to talk about the kids. Kelly informed her that Fred had a will stating that the kids would go to his brother, not to her. After hearing this, Piper became angry. She told Kelly that she was their mother, but before she could continue, her phone went dead. The next day, Detective Kelly arrived in Houston with his partner. They met with HPD, and then they all went to speak with Piper. After tracking her down, officers asked where she was that weekend. Piper became uncomfortable and squirmed. Officers asked if she was in Virginia on October 30th, and she said no. One of the officers later said he could tell that Piper was lying. She was slow to answer and was evasive. They asked her where she was on October 30th and if anyone saw her. She said she was, right here. And they asked, in this room? And she said no, she was working in Houston and Galveston. She couldn't give a clear answer on where exactly she was working. She said she was all over. Piper said she was in her car driving from Galveston when she called Paxton. Police kept trying to get Piper to tell them exactly where she was. She finally gave in and said she was with a married man, and that's why she wasn't being truthful. The officers reminded Piper that this was a homicide investigation and she needed to tell the truth no matter how embarrassing it was. And then Piper changed her story. She had been at Tina's house, but Tina wasn't there. Officers kept questioning Piper. They said if she gave them information, they could try to work something out with CPS. With a mention of getting to see her children, Piper asked the officers if they had talked to Fred's girlfriend. She said they had been dating for 5 years, 2 years before the divorce, that Fred cheated on her a lot. But of course, she hadn't noticed because she was too busy caring for her kids. Can you hear my eyes rolling? Knowing they weren't getting anywhere, officers decided to end the conversation. Piper promised to call Detective Kelly at 6 o'clock that night so they could talk about custody of the kids. She said she would provide Kelly with the name of the married man she was with during the murder. Now the police headed to Tina's place to talk to her. They asked if she had seen Piper on October 29th or 30th. Tina was evasive. She wouldn't answer any questions. Instead, she just kept asking about the children. After some time, Tina said she would tell the officers where her sister was on the 29th and 30th, but only if they brought the kids to Texas. They asked where she was on October 29th and if she saw Piper. It was an easy question, but Tina wouldn't answer it. Again, she said she was not going to talk to them. Then she yelled at them to leave. That afternoon, Piper told Detective Kelly that she didn't want to talk because she felt like she was between a rock and a hard place. He asked if she felt like she was being accused of anything. She said she was exhausted and needed to figure out how to get her kids. They agreed to meet the next day at 9 a.m. But that meeting never happened because Piper called Detective Kelly and said she couldn't meet him due to the thunderstorms. When the storms passed, she asked her former boss to tell the police that she had talked to an attorney in Virginia, and they suggested that she not talk to the police as anything she said could hurt her case. What case if she was innocent? Her custody case, I suppose. Fred did name his brother Michael as guardian of his children, but still. With the Roundtree sisters not talking, officers kept digging, hoping they would find enough evidence for an arrest. They found that Piper used a friend's account to purchase two wigs at Paris Boutique Wigs. The wigs, one red, the other blonde, were long and flowing. Police also noticed that the same friend's debit card was used on October 28th through the 30th in the Richmond area. One of the purchases was at CVS for makeup and a box of small latex gloves. They obtained camera footage from places the debit card was used. One tape from a 7-Eleven showed a woman who looked like Piper wearing a blonde wig similar to the one bought on the website. On November 2nd, police found that one of Piper's calls in Virginia was to a Papa John's. They called the pizza place and asked if a person with the last name of Roundtree ordered a pizza. They had. It was delivered to Homestead Suites to room 171 on the 28th. Police went to Homestead Suites and asked who rented room 171. The manager on duty from that night said it was a woman. She checked in at 9:50 on the night of the 28th under the name Tina Roundtree. Then she asked to change the name on the register to Geraldine Smith. The woman paced the lobby and looked nervous, according to the manager. Officers showed the manager a photo of Piper. They confirmed that it was the woman who checked in that night. She had been wearing a hat, coat, scarf, and sunglasses, even though it wasn't cold out and it was nighttime. Next, Henrico officers found that a Tina Roundtree had called around October 24th, asking if she could rent a car later that week without a credit card. The clerk said she could, but she needed to bring a driver's license and utility bill. This Tina asked to reserve a car, but they said they only rented on a first-come, first-served basis. At around 5 p.m. on October 28th, this Tina called the company from the airport asking them to hold a car for her. When she got there, the clerk noticed she was clearly wearing a wig and heavy makeup. After handing over her driver's license and utility bill, Tina said she would return the car on the 30th. Police showed the clerk a photo of Tina, but the clerk didn't think that was the woman they had seen. Then officers showed a photo of Piper, and the clerk was 100% sure it was her. Unfortunately, the van had already been cleaned, rented to someone else, and returned back to the rental agency. The police still went through the van to see if they could find anything. They found one piece of evidence, a key to Homestead Suites. Meanwhile, Detective Kobe Kelly was still in Houston. He went to Tina's clinic and talked to her medical assistant. He asked the assistant if she saw Tina on the 30th. The assistant said yes. Tina had appointments with patients until 12:30. At that time, she got a phone call and left in a hurry. Next, Kelly looked into the flights Tina, aka Piper, had taken between Houston and Norfolk. He spoke with the ticket agent who checked Piper in for her flight in Houston. The agent remembered Piper because, quote, she was a really cute woman who was wearing a blonde wig. Detective Kelly showed the employee a photo of Piper, and she confirmed that it was the woman she had seen. She recalled that Tina was in a rush. She needed to be on the next available flight to Norfolk, and she had a gun to declare. Tina hesitated when the clerk told her the gun had to be inspected. She fumbled around and finally got it out and showed that it wasn't loaded. Then the agent gave Piper forms to fill out and called over a TSA agent to inspect the gun. Detective Kelly talked to the TSA agent who inspected the gun. He said it was a revolver. When shown a photo of Piper, he said he thought it was Piper, but he wasn't sure. The hair was different. Meanwhile, Piper got a hotel room to avoid the police. She did not fly to Virginia to attend Fred's funeral with her children. Instead, she went to the Volcano Bar and asked the bartender if she remembered seeing her on Friday, October 29th. The bartender, Cheryl, said she thought so, but wasn't sure if it was Friday or not. Piper said she needed to find the married man she had been talking to that night. Cheryl turned to a group of people and asked if any of them had seen Piper. A man named Kevin said he thought he remembered seeing her and then asked why it was important. Piper said that she got a call from Virginia police that her ex-boyfriend had been stabbed to death and police wanted to know where she was. Piper asked Kevin for the best way to get a hold of him in case she needed him to prove where she was. He gave Piper his number, and then she left. A few minutes later, Piper went back inside the bar, this time accompanied with Tina and two men in business suits. The men asked Kevin to sign a statement and have it notarized so she could prove she was there on Friday. He said no and said that she had his number. If the police wanted to talk, they could call. Piper started arguing with Kevin, but Tina told her they needed to leave. Piper later let Detective Kelly know about Kevin and the bartender, Cheryl. She said she was still trying to find the married man who walked her home. Kelly set up a meeting with Kevin at the Volcano Bar. Kevin relayed the story Piper told him about her ex-boyfriend getting stabbed. Detective Kelly said it was her former husband of 18 years who had been shot. Kevin then admitted that he wasn't 100% sure he saw Piper at the bar on Friday night. Detective Kelly asked the bartender, Cheryl, to check the tabs. Then she realized Kevin hadn't even been in the bar on Friday. That meant he couldn't have seen Piper. Then they figured out that Kevin and Cheryl were both at the bar on Saturday night, and that's when they had seen Piper. She had gone to the bar the same day she killed her husband. I'm going to pause now for a final commercial break. After the revelations at the Volcano Bar, police found out that Piper asked Tina to stay the night at her house on the night of October 29th. This way, when a neighbor delivering Girl Scout cookies came by, she would think Piper was home. But Piper's plan didn't work. The neighbor realized the person who answered the door wasn't Piper. This woman was bigger. And Tina, crack criminal that she was, parked her car outside of Piper's house. On November 6th, police met with a friend of Tina and Piper's named Carol. They had received a tip that she knew something about the murder. During their meeting, Carol told the police everything she knew. On the 28th, the same day Piper left for Virginia, Tina contacted Carol to say that she thought Piper was going to do something stupid. Piper had taken off with Tina's driver's license and credit card, and the week before, she had gone to a shooting range with Tina's boyfriend for practice. Carol said that on October 31st, Tina called crying because Piper had gone to Virginia and killed her ex. Tina went on to detail how she helped Piper dispose of evidence, including a purse and a wig. Tina put them in grocery bags and threw them in two dumpsters, one at a medical center and one at a convenience store. After Carol told Tina that the dumpsters weren't safe, they decided to retrieve the bags. When they were done, Tina dropped Carol off at work, and when she came back to get her, the bags were gone from the car and it had been washed inside and out. Carol said that the next day she went to Tina's house. While there, Piper arrived. Carol asked Piper where the gun was, and she said she didn't know. Then Piper asked if either Carol or Tina knew someone who could change a hard drive. Piper also asked Carol to get rid of the garbage bags in her garage and to throw out the desktop, tower, and laptop. Tina suggested Carol take her computer too. After she thought things over, Carol started worrying. She ended up contacting a lawyer who told her to give the evidence to the police. Instead, she gave it all back to Piper. Carol later signed an immunity agreement. As the investigation went on, Piper called Detective Kelly a few times to see how it was going. He thought Piper was feeling him out to see if she was going to be arrested. Piper was right to worry. The prosecution finally felt like they had enough to charge Piper with two counts of unlawful use of a firearm and first-degree murder. They made plans to arrest her as she left a custody hearing in Virginia on the afternoon of November 8th. They also obtained an arrest warrant for Tina for helping cover up the murder. On November 8th, Henrico police headed to the Henrico County Courthouse where Piper was attending the custody hearing. The judge ruled that the children would stay with their uncle and aunt until the investigation into Fred's murder was over. Then another hearing would be ordered. After Piper left the courthouse, officers followed her and then pulled her over at a stoplight. They boxed her in with four cars. Piper was arrested and taken back to the police station. Officers knew she wouldn't speak to them, so they asked who her lawyer was. She said her lawyer was Murray Janice, a high-profile defense attorney. Janice was called to the police station, and Piper never talked to the police again. Back in Houston, officers were busy arresting Tina at her clinic. They brought her back to the police station. They told her that if she helped them, they might help her not lose her nursing license, as well as help her avoid possible jail time. Tina said she wanted to talk to an attorney. She refused to talk to the police further and was later released on bond. On November 11th, a judge ruled that Piper was not eligible for bond. While awaiting trial, she called the kids from jail but got no answer. She wrote them letters instead. She wrote that the police had told her she was cleared as a suspect and she didn't understand why she was still in jail. The children eventually wrote their mother back and talked about their new lives. Piper's trial began on February 22, 2005. The prosecution said Piper killed Fred so she could regain custody of the kids, stop making child support payments, and probably most importantly, get his $200,000 life insurance policy that she was still the beneficiary of. They said that Piper planned the murder and then covered it up. The following timeline is what the prosecution presented. On October 28th, Piper arrived in Norfolk. She rented a van using Tina's ID and utility bill and then drove to Richmond. She spent the next two nights in the hotel. On the morning of the 30th, Piper drove to Fred's and ambushed him in his driveway, shooting him to death as their children slept just inside the house. 90 minutes later, she stopped for gas before she returned the van in Norfolk just after 9 a.m. Then she flew back to Houston. The defense's strategy was to plant reasonable doubt. They suggested Tina was the guilty party, not Piper. No one saw Piper pull the trigger, and there was no forensic evidence tying her to the scene. No one could say that the cell phone pings were made by Piper herself. And everything was in Tina's name, not Piper's. Piper was too smart to leave behind so many breadcrumbs. Piper testified that she did not kill Fred. She also said that she did not own a .38, but Tina did. Also, she said she didn't own any wigs, but Tina did. And Tina used her cell phone all the time. When asked if she wanted the jury to believe Tina was the murderer, Piper said she had no idea what happened. On February 26th, the jury deliberated for less than an hour before finding Piper guilty of first-degree murder and use of a firearm during commission of a felony. Piper cried when the verdict was read. According to her friend Lonnie, she truly thought she was going to be acquitted. Next, the jury needed to make a sentencing recommendation to the judge. They recommended the maximum, life in prison. One jury member said they decided quickly they didn't want Piper to come back into the lives of her children. They were better off without her. On May 6th, Piper was sentenced to life in prison, plus 3 years. In November 2005, Tina took a deal and pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge of tampering with evidence. She was sentenced to 9 months, deferred adjudication, a $300 fine, and 80 hours of community service. She kept her license and clinic. Piper later appealed her convictions and sentences, both of which were affirmed. Today, Piper Ann Rowntree is incarcerated at Fluvanna Correctional Center for Women in Troy, Virginia, where she has been extremely litigious, suing her warden and other prison workers for various offenses, including supposedly being deprived of her Bible. Tina, always protective of her baby sister, actually told reporters in 2014, after one lawsuit, that prison officials were scared of Piper because she used to be a prosecutor in Texas. Tina neglected to mention that Piper had been fired after 1 year with the DA's office. I swear, these two harebrained criminals would be hilarious if we were not talking about the brutal murder of Fred Jablin, father of three. You don't see many mentions of the Jablin kids in these more recent articles. Thank God. From what I can tell, they are all flourishing adults with different careers around the country. Hopefully, as adults, they moved on with their lives and are not saddled themselves with the burden of maintaining a relationship with their mother in prison, not after what she did to them. When Piper was convicted, her high-profile attorney, Murray Janice, announced that he would not be representing her in any appeals and asked the court to appoint a public defender. Virginia has some different laws regarding parole, specifically that once a prisoner turns 60 or has served 15 years, that could apply. Janice told the press at the time of her conviction that he didn't believe any parole board would let Piper Rowntree out. He was right. She is exactly where she belongs. Piper's first chance at parole was in 2020 when she was 60, but it was denied. The reasons given were that her release would diminish the seriousness of the crime and the serious nature and circumstances of the offense. Her next chance at parole will be in 2033 when she is 73 years old. This is the part of the episode where I usually wonder about the why. But we know why Piper did it. Sure. Fred's life insurance policy would obviously be a motive for a woman who hemorrhaged money the way she did, although I seriously doubt $200,000 would have even lasted a year in her hands. But I think it's painfully obvious Piper's motive was really revenge. She was furious she had lost to Fred. I don't even think she wanted custody of her children in any real sense of that concept. She had never been a real mother to them. I will say it is obvious she suffered from depression, and especially postpartum depression, and that is truly sad. But there is a quote I've seen floating around the last few years that I feel strongly applies to Piper Rountree. Your mental illness is not your fault, but it is your responsibility. It's a quote thrown around more and more as we speak more openly about mental health issues. But it is also true legally, both criminally and in civil suits. Piper saw any number of therapists, including psychiatrists, over the years, and her victim went to couples counseling faithfully with her. He supported her. He wanted her to get better. She had much more support and help than many people get for their mental health struggles. Piper knew what she was doing. She knew right from wrong. She hurt her children, often neglecting them for her own selfishness. She was a hateful, spiteful woman. And she is a cold-blooded murderer. Fred Jablin was the epitome of a nice guy. He had truly loved his wife, despite how emotionally abusive, not to mention financially abusive, she was to him. Even after all she did to him and said about him and humiliated him, Fred always remained civil and friendly to his ex-wife. He went above and beyond in communicating with her about their children. He always tried to do the right thing. Fred just wanted peace. He wanted to make sure his children were safe. And he wanted to move on with his life, with a woman he cared about, and one who finally cared about his feelings and treated him with love and respect. Instead, he was brutally shot down by his ex-wife in his own driveway as their children were sleeping inside his house. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Haley Gray. As always, editorial opinions are all mine, especially my closing and especially any sarcasm. But the rest is all from Haley. I could not survive Spooky Month without her. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio and the original graphic artist by Coley Horner. If you have any case suggestions, please go to my website and click on the listener suggestion tab. This is the best way for me to get to those little-known cases y'all always send me. Please remember that I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages. With 3 platforms to manage, that is very overwhelming for me. I hope you understand. But please come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. I much prefer spending my social media time in our lovely group. We do, of course, discuss true crime, not just Southern Fried, but all kinds, but it is still very much a Southern lifestyle group. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, please don't forget to subscribe and tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on all large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, Spotify, and now Amazon and Audible. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.